Hi, this is Dr. Diane Heinemann, publisher of Natural Nut Night magazine, and today I have on the line with me Dr. Penelope McDonald. She's one of our authors for our book that's about to be released in just over a month, I think, Essential Remedies for Women's Health, which has great information on everything from adrenal fatigue support to thyroid health to pre-pregnancy and pregnancy support to weight loss and fitness. And what Dr. McDonald is going to be talking about today is actually some really interesting information on polycystic ovarian syndrome, urinary tract infections, and interstitial cystitis. So she is going to be with us today. She's graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in the Columbia School of Business and worked on Wall Street for many years. After taking time off to start a family, she decided to switch careers and attended the University of Bridgeport School of Naturopathic Medicine. She graduated with the highest honors, and during her final year of study, she interned at St. Vincent Hospital's Department of Internal Medicine in Bridgeport, and she has also interned at both the Cancer Treatment Centers of America and an integrative treatment center that focused on patients with Lyme disease, cancer, and autism. Dr. McDonald focuses on prevention as the primary strategy for maintaining health. Her treatment plans generally include a combination of natural medicines and specific lifestyle changes designed to bring balance to every system of the body. And she is particularly interested in treating challenging health problems caused by hormone imbalance, autoimmune disease, digestive problems, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, cancer, aging, and thyroid imbalance. So welcome to the call, Penelope. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you so much, Diane, for having me.
Sure. So you had a very interesting chapter in this upcoming book, and I think that along with a lot of other interesting chapters, and it's been great, the calls that we've done so far talking about all the misinformation that's out there on everything from adrenal fatigue to thyroid dysfunction, but I think you have the topic that a lot of women don't want to talk about.
I agree. Yes, it's true. And I see so much suffering as a result. And every time my patients and I connect by email, as a matter of fact, you may laugh, but I have a woman who emailed me this morning at 5:45 this morning. I happened to be out, and she said, "I really think I'm getting a UTI. Help."
Oh, God.
And I thought, oh, I'm so glad she did, because I have my little, little prep suggestions for her to run out and try. And because a lot of women will either suffer in silence, or they sometimes don't have the best advice for how to deal with it. And also with PCOS, lots of suffering in silence. And that's really one of the reasons why I wanted to write about this. I hoped it would be a resource for women, at least a springboard, to help them along the path of understanding what they have, maybe finding some causes that they didn't know were causes, and help in healing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Anything that deals with, I think, female organs.
Yep.
we're kind of a little shy, and it's very interesting because, like, UTIs are very common, and I think that, most women know, if they've had one, it's something that you don't forget. So when you're getting it again. But PCOS and interstitial cystitis, I think, are things that some people may never have even heard those terms. And so I kind of want to start there because we can get to the UTI stuff later in the call, but polycystic ovarian syndrome is something I think is becoming more common, and yet a lot of people have no idea, what it is or why it's affecting them. So I wanted to start out by asking you, what your thoughts were on why it's so hard to diagnose and what you think the root causes are.
Well, PCOS is a sum of so many other diagnoses. I have women who walk into my office and say, "I'm insulin resistant, but yet I have all these other symptoms, and I'm trying to address my insulin, but I'm having all these strange hormone issues." And, we sort of have to dig into what all of those pieces as a conglomerate may give us as a diagnosis. But it is difficult because there are just so many pieces. You can have individual characteristics, pre-diabetes or diabetes. A woman can come in with infertility She doesn't know why she's not getting pregnant. That may be one of the only signs that she may have PCOS. And I'll get into the root causes in a minute and how you can have sort of a range of PCOS and in terms of intensity in your body. You can have elevated triglycerides and you may not really know why. You may have elevated triglycerides along with hair or hirsutism, as it's medically called, on your chest, your buttocks, your arms, or head hair. Your hair is falling out and you're too young to have that happen. You certainly don't want to ever have that happen. Or, back to infertility, frequent miscarriages or anovulatory. And it can run the range of ages and sort of looks different almost at every age. I have women who come in that are teenagers that are struggling with this, with one set of symptoms, another maybe is trying to get pregnant with another. Yet another woman has a lot of weight gain and she doesn't understand why. She was able to have children and yet she's following a lot of the pre-diabetes guidelines and she's just not able to make to be successful. And that is usually something we dig into and start running hormone panels and run some ratios to see if PCOS is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The root cause, which was the second part of your question, there are so many theories. At the end of the day, your genes make something called D-chiroinositol. And that D-chiroinositol is critical. Every cell in the body needs to take, most every cell in the body needs to take glucose in for it to allow it to function. And this D-chiroinositol is critical in the mechanism that the cell uses to pull glucose into the cell. When this mechanism either sputters or slows down or halts, then glucose goes up in the blood. This causes the pancreas to shoot out lots of insulin, because insulin is what the body uses to push the glucose into the cell and really strong arm it in. As a result of all of these organs trying to compensate for these poor cells who just don't have the machinery to pull the glucose in, you end up with blood with very high insulin levels inside of it. That starts a cascade of hormone issues. Your ovaries and other hormone-making organs and your liver and its conversion of hormones all start creating androgens. Testosterone is the most famous of the androgens and creates hormone imbalances as a result. So it starts with a small cell having a sputtering engine unable to take in the glucose, and it ends with a cascade of hormonal strangeness that happens to a woman. And it can vary. For instance, you may have a mild case of this. Your DNA is making some D-chiroinositol, but not a lot, and you're sort of okay in your earlier years. But say through diet or stress or childbearing, your body's inability to handle sugar starts to decrease. Then the factor of PCOS and the degree that you have it can actually start playing a major role in the cascade of illness that may ensue. And that's why you see this sort of rear its ugly head at different ages, because other factors can sort of move in. It's very complicated.
Yeah, and is there any reason why this mechanism starts to malfunction?
So thinking is that when you're in utero, the baby is exposed to high levels of testosterone. There's a lot of research that's been done to try and understand why this DNA mechanism is failed. And that is the latest thinking, is exposure. There's also thinking, as you know, I'm sure you've read a lot, and listeners as well, about the bisphenols and how we're getting things from plastics that are estrogenic. And that also may play a role in utero. That's a newer theory that's being tossed around. But at the end of the day, we're really not quite sure what environmental factors are triggering this issue that happens to us as we develop in utero.
Fascinating. Yeah. You talked a little bit about the symptoms to look for. Was there anything else that you could think of? Or?
So anyone with, if it's a teenager, she usually has irregular missed periods. She's watching all of her friends eat sugar. they don't seem to be gaining the weight that she's gaining. Her diet hasn't changed from the year before, but her waistline has. You know, a teenager that, say, misses a period over a six-month period of time, I mean, obviously, teenage periods can be quite erratic, but this would be longer than, say, 2 or 3 months. You know, again, anyone who has a recurrent miscarriage, acne, too, is a large part of PCOS when it's combined with the other symptoms. You'll also sometimes see a deepening of pigmentation in the groin area or the armpits or behind the knees. That's often a sign of sugar dysregulation that you see. You'll also, obviously, given the name of polycystic ovarian syndrome, you will see ovarian cysts, but not always. So not in all cases.
Okay.
And then you can also see rapid weight gain, and that can happen at any age and for many reasons. So that's why, you know, there's so many possibilities behind rapid weight gain. Sometimes you really have to dig in and see if this is part of the picture.
Oh, right, because many people might say, the first thought might be, oh, it's a thyroid issue, or I'm just getting older, my metabolism is slowing down.
Exactly, and that's a huge issue, and I find there are different sets of herbs that I use for PCOS specifically, and I find when those herbal combinations, and there are, of course, dietary things, which we'll get into, but that those herbal combinations, when they're sort of included in the mix with the other potential cures, if you will, or whatever the patient has already been diagnosed with, it actually potentiates those cures. It makes them work better if that added piece is put in place.
Right. So what are some of your dietary recommendations? I mean, I'm sure there, you know, as I was reading through your chapter, there's many, many different herbs and homeopathic things, but I think those are things that you really want to be working with, you know, your practitioner on, and not just necessarily running out to your local
yes.
health store.
Sure.
What can people do, you know, initially as far as making changes to their diet?
Well, two things. Although this isn't dietary, I have been blown away in the under 30 set, the infertile or teenage group that suffers from PCOS, with the effect of really rigorous exercise. You know, and you know, starting with something like an hour 3 days a week, and working up where you're really sweating. That's actually a key factor in dietary changes. Is also strenuous sweating exercise. Obviously, you want to be checked out that you can do that. Depends on the weight that you're starting. You want to work up slowly, but that needs to be the end goal. It amazes me how diet combined with exercise is so much more effective in terms of regulating the blood sugar issue that is underneath PCOS. In terms of specific diets, I really, really like the low glycemic diet. There's lots of information on the internet about it. It's very good. There are lots of charts explaining. The low glycemic diet is a list of foods that, when you eat them, they don't cause spikes in blood sugar. So included in the list would be a bowl of whole wheat pasta, most vegetables and most meats, and eggs as well, nuts, and some fruits. Cherries are a particularly good fruit, and apples are a particularly good fruit. Also legumes and lentils, again, high in protein. So obviously stay away from simple carbs, and there are some complex carbs that are not so kind to your blood sugar as well. Definitely try and stay away from flour. I often recommend that very red meat and dairy. So I prefer chicken or fish over the dairy and red meat. And also just really, you know, what you always read about a good diet, lots of good fats, increase your vegetables to a goodly portion of the total intake of your day, at least half.
Right, right. And it's funny because as I talk to each author of their chapter, no matter what it is, whether it is adrenal fatigue or thyroid dysfunction or whatever, everyone's saying the same thing, you know, and it's like, it's not a coincidence that we're all, you know, proponents of this more natural, whole food, low glycemic index type of diet, it's, you know, gee, I wonder why we got into having all of these different chronic diseases. Well, isn't it kind of funny that it all goes back to the fact that we're eating too many processed foods, too much sugar, not enough exercise. It's, you know, it's not rocket science, but yet, I don't know, it seems like...
I think I was just walking down the street the other day, and I think I really couldn't go 10 feet without either seeing a sign for sugar, something in a window with sugar. I think it's really, really challenging to eat well with television, with magazines. I find actually, I was listening to a lecture by Dr. Mark Hyman recently, and his theory is that the secret sauce to a good diet is the buddy system and getting people around you to eat well also. I often recommend to my patients, try and get your whole family to do this with you. Try and get friends to go out with you that will eat, you know, eat well as well. It's just really hard with all the goodies we're constantly bombarded with.
It's not an educational thing. It's not like people don't know what they are supposed to be eating or not eating. It's like you said, we're constantly bombarded, whether it's walking down the street or on the television or even in magazines or, you know, driving down the highway or every other billboard is for McDonald's or God knows what else. So you're right, yeah.
It's also expensive. I try and recommend, I know we're getting a bit off topic, but I try and recommend that my patients have Sunday be a soup day, that they make enough soup for the week ahead, because it's time consuming to source, healthier foods. I try to recommend frozen organic vegetables and fruits because I find them to be less expensive, although it's still more than a candy bar. It's hard.
Yeah, but you know what I tell people? I mean, you can save money now by eating inexpensive, less healthy food, but you're going to be paying more money later treating whatever issue that you wind up with.
Yeah.
So,
no,
it's a mindset, you know?
It's true. It's true. Yeah, I agree.
So back on topic. we'll get off our...
I did want to add, I really do like cinnamon for any kind of blood sugar dysregularity. It is important that you understand that cinnamon is something very easy to choke on. It's actually, believe it or not, a spice that has, I think it's number one for choking. So I recommend patients either mix it with food or stir it in with some water. Make sure you put, if you really are going to have a latte, put some cinnamon in.
That's a great idea. So next topic is interstitial cystitis. And again, another situation that seems to be very hard to diagnose. And so, just elaborate a little bit on that and what you think some of the root causes are.
These women are really suffering. And again, as with PCOS, although maybe a little more narrow, the real root cause, this is a bladder dysfunction. Your bladder, as you know, as we all know, expands and contracts. And when you have interstitial cystitis, your bladder stops being able to expand and contract as it should, and it starts to get leaky. There's actually an issue with the cells connecting, and fluid or minerals that shouldn't be leaking out are and cause pain and discomfort. So many of the women that suffer from interstitial cystitis think they have chronic urinary tract infections, but their urine samples keep coming back with no bacteria. They think that they may have kidney stones, but they don't, or they start with kidney stones, but the symptoms remain after that's been taken care of. They have been tested for sexually transmitted diseases. They may or may not have endometriosis. A lot needs to be taken off the table. It's unfortunately one of the, another diagnosis of last resort. And but it's a very uncomfortable disease of the cellular dysfunction. The theory, the thinking behind interstitial cystitis and the root cause is it's some type of autoimmune inflammation has affected these cells. There is also some thinking that Lyme could be affecting the bladder. It's known that Lyme does hide in the bladder. It's one of the places that it goes to escape antibiotics. But I don't find that any of the Lyme cures, if you will, or the Lyme support actually addresses interstitial cystitis. But that is probably potentially one of the root causes. Women usually get this in their early years, mid-20s to 40s, and it can actually come and go. You can have flares, and that really depends a lot on food, which we'll probably get to in a moment, and stress, lifestyle. But it can really interfere with a woman's life. Intercourse can be painful. This is a woman who doesn't enter a room without wondering or looking around for the bathroom. Some women have to wear very special clothing. They may have huge sensitivities to non-natural fabrics in their underwear or their skirts that they wear. A huge general sensitivity in the abdominal area. Very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know a lot of friends who, when they were pregnant, would tell me they were always trying to figure out where the bathrooms were.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, that's something that's temporary.
Exactly.
Having to manage that all the time has got to be awful.
Yeah, it is. And when they're very compliant patients, I will say, and I find, you know, the thing that I start with them is actually diet. That tends to be where we go first, because they're very compliant in what they will do, and the dietary restrictions for interstitial cystitis. A wonderful woman named Kay Willard did a lot of research on different foods that she found created problems for women with interstitial cystitis, and came up with a list of 30, which is a huge list, and doesn't really seem to have any correlation among themselves. And I think 100% of the time my patients have had relief when they have taken all these foods out, whether they can, and then they slowly reintroduce. And it's not complete relief all the time. It always amazes me how much diet can affect interstitial cystitis.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, just like anything else, really. And I would imagine they're very compliant because it's a very uncomfortable thing to live with. So.
Yeah, and it has to be these specific 30 foods, which is,
yeah. I find that the more pain somebody is in, the more painful something is, the more willing they are to change something.
I know. Yes, it's true. And also, I find as a practitioner, the more pain my patient is in, the harder I work.
Yeah, well, that's true, I know.
You know, they've been through so much.
Right, I know. So, do you want to talk a little bit about the dietary recommendations?
Sure. I'll read a few. Aspartame and synthetic sugar is in here. Nuts, except for peanuts and almonds. But, you know, this, again, go figure. You know, spicy foods and carbonated drinks. A lot of the citrus sort of makes sense, but things like chicken livers and rye bread. I know. Chicken livers, rye bread, corned beef, coffee, which I can see. Guava, who knew? Saccharin and pickled herring. I don't really know how this list evolved, but it's a killer list, and it works most of the time.
Yeah. Any recommendations as far as exercise? Like, is it the same effect for PCOS as it does for interstitial cystitis?
No, I don't find exercise. Actually, the exercise that I send these women home with are stress reduction exercise. I'm a real fan of a company called Health Journeys. They have some very nice, relaxing stress relief and sleep support, guided imagery, meditation CDs. I do also like Qigong very much. There are tons of CDs and videos and YouTube snippets that you can look at for Qigong. Anything that relaxes these sufferers, the stress level is huge. And I often recommend the kava teas, you know, any or calm tea, you know, breathing, anything that can support for them getting through the pain. Because
Right. Rather, it's
the pain. So.
Yep. It's very interesting because I don't think a lot of people correlate the fact that exercise also causes stress. I mean, we're always saying how great it is and everyone should do it and, you know, the reasons why and whatnot. But, of course, I mean, it increases your cortisol levels and it is a stressor on the body, even though it has so many health benefits.
Yes, and exactly. And I do often start with just breathing and gentle meditation. Of course, walking is always number one, but these women are often so much discomfort they can't. They can't go to swimming pools. They certainly can't wear bathing suits. They have, most of them have sensitivity to chlorine. So it's very debilitating when it comes to activity. So I try and start with walking if they're comfortable with that, with lots of deep breathing, nice guided imagery to start, and breathing, as I said. Can't say enough about breathing.
Yep, that's great. That's great. So that brings us to the most common piece that you talk about in your chapter, urinary tract infections. So I'm sure you can talk about some of the root causes. I think what a lot of people might want to know, though, is how come they're so, once you have one, it seems like it's so easy for them to reoccur. And, you know, is there any reason why that's happening or anything that women can do to counteract that?
Yes. I'd like to address that in two ways. One, I find that the perimenopausal group of women, I find that that happens quite a bit to them, and I want to explain why. And then for the younger group of women, well, let's just start with the perimenopausal group. I'm finding in treating this demographic that because of the changes in estrogen, studies have shown that as your estrogen levels change, your flora, both in your gut and in your vagina, the balance changes. You have, as a young ovulating woman, you have a much higher percentage of, to use terms we all know and love, good probiotics and good bacteria versus the negative bacteria. So I see in my patients in this phase of life that they'll start getting UTIs, and they won't understand why they're confusing. They're not really changing much in their lifestyle and diet. They're pretty seasoned women. They know that after intercourse they need to go and urinate, that sort of thing. They're careful about not sitting around in a bathing suit. And I find those women may start needing some of the dietary suggestions and supplement suggestions that are easy for us all to access on the shelf, which I'll get into in a moment. And also, I recommend potentially a douche with probiotics into the vagina. Of course, it would have to be a good quality powdered probiotic. But rebalancing the vaginal flora often helps. And in doing this, sometimes it feeds in a way that helps prevent further urinary tract infections. In the younger population, if they have a repeating urinary tract infections, of course we dig into lifestyle and really try and understand if there is anything that we've missed that might be causing a recurrence. Could it be a detergent that's recently been changed? I see this surprisingly high amount, new detergent causing UTIs, and they just don't connect that this is happening. I also find that baths, they're starting to use something wonderful and lavendery smelling in the bathtub occasionally. And can they correlate that with recurrent UTIs? And I try to dig into lifestyle as much as possible before I recommend to somebody that they start taking freeze-dried cranberry regularly. And that's usually my start. And that's easy to get in most health food stores or grocery stores. It's a good quality cranberry in a capsule, and we take a little every day. I don't recommend cranberry juice because I find that you have to drink so much for it to be effective, and there's so much natural sugar.
I was going to say, here we go again with the sugar.
I know.
Yep.
I know. I just don't, I like it, and the quality of the freeze-dried cranberry seems to be quite good that you can get. They really do seem to have cranberry in the capsule, I'm sure you, and everyone is aware of the issue now with, are we really putting into our mouth what's inside the capsule, what the box says is inside the capsule. But I find with cranberry, it's pretty good. And then D-mannose is a natural sugar, also easy to find in the health food stores. And it is a sugar, but it binds to E. coli. I don't usually use that as a prophylactic as much as I would just recommend a bit of cranberry. And I find that if we can get through, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 months, they're usually pretty good to go. Then they don't have to, but you can pretty much be guaranteed they'll be taking that little bottle of cranberry with them on the next vacation. If they don't want.
And certainly I think that most women are aware of what the symptoms are. Is there anything, I don't know, out of the ordinary that people should be looking for? I mean,
you don't often have a very bad vaginal smell. Bacterial vaginosis is something that would need to be ruled out if your discharge if you have a colorful discharge. That's either green or yellow, or you could also have a yeast infection. Yeast infections can make you feel like you have a UTI, but it's really yeast. So there are definitely things that can masquerade as a UTI that you have to really sort of ask yourself, am I seeing discharge? Is this near my period? Or, you know, is this near... I find women tend to have UTI symptoms right before their period, and then they seem to pass. So that could be just irritation that they're suffering from before they get their period. I guess also kidney stones, other bladder dysfunction. You know, we're back to interstitial cystitis. A lot of reasons of frequent urination and the desire to void are not bacterial. They can be kidney stones. You can have some kind of structural dysfunction going on that you would need to get checked out, especially if you actually do have frequent infections, nothing, prevention's not working, we've gone into your lifestyle, then it is important to go and get the structure of your urogenital system scanned to make sure that there's nothing wrong or changed there.
So there might be other things going on in addition to that, for sure.
Yep, and food allergies actually, stress, all of those things that we keep harping back to can also play a role in increase the frequency of UTIs or in feeling like you have the symptoms. You can also have, during intercourse, an allergy to spermicide, and that can cause an inflammation and burning that makes you feel like you have to void frequently. But there's no bacteria, that's just an allergic reaction. I also find that, getting back to your question of why do some women get frequent UTIs, antibiotics can lower even further the good gut flora. Even if you're taking probiotics while you're taking antibiotics and you're good, it's still not necessarily improving the vaginal flora, which, as we've discussed, changes as you age. So if you have been taking lots of antibiotics, even if it's not for a urinary tract infection, you could potentially start suffering from urinary tract infections, and that's sort of a heads up that probiotics could play a role in the cure.
Right. Yep. And so, you mentioned cranberry, but what other dietary suggestions would you make?
Again, probiotics. I guess, all the normal diet stuff, and I hate to use the word stuff, all the wonderful dietary suggestions we've had, more fruits and vegetables, anything that supports your immune system, and a good diet of, half vegetables, lean meats, good fats, lots and lots of good fats, reduced sugar, all of those things. And, of course, in my mind, probably number one, a good night's sleep helps your immune system.
Right. Right, that makes sense, too. What about thoughts on exercise for this particular issue, too?
I don't find that, again, it's interesting, both with interstitial cystitis and UTIs. If this is a stressed person, really hard driving, and I send them out to do cardio, it's really going to inflame them. It is important to get exercise. It just really depends on the stress profile of the patient. That's where I may be back to, deep breathing, calm, relaxing, walking with intention. I do like, light weights. I like, push-ups, sit-ups, that sort of thing, done moderately as long as they're not uncomfortable. But it really depends on how stressed. I find, interestingly, my hard-driving, really stressed patients are usually doing cardio.
Of course, right? For hour a day.
Yeah. they're those type A people, and they're doing type A exercises. And I'm constantly saying, if you're type A, you need to do some type B exercises.
Exactly.
And I know that's hard. And if you start to meditate and it's like chalk on a blackboard, get a nice walking meditation CD so you can move and meditate.
Right. I would think strength training might be good for all of these different situations, because I'm just thinking about the ability to enhance insulin sensitivity. So we're talking a lot about, you know, these people that are having, you know, issues with glucose regulation. So adding a strength training program might be something that's not quite as stressful as, you know, the hours of cardio that they spend on the treadmill, and
help them
with insulin sensitivity.
Yes. Well, PCOS is a big exception. If they have a hard driving job and they're exercising, I want them to exercise more, because that for some reason seems to be a pretty good trade-off of the inflammation that type A exercise may create versus the incredible support for sugar regulation, insulin, and glucose that comes from really hard exercise. So that's a group where I may say, okay, well, a little meditation would be nice, but go to town with the aerobic exercises.
Right. Yep. Well, that's great. I think that we clarified a lot of things for people today surrounding all these different issues. Anything else that you can think of that you wanted to comment on?
Just looking over my notes, I think we've pretty much covered everything.
Yeah. So how can people contact you if they want to learn more? Do you want to send them to your website or email, or what do you want to do?
Email is always the best.
Okay.
That works the best. Of course, they can go to my website as well. My contact information is there. The drmcdonnell@naturopathicpartners.com is my email address, and that's the best way to go forward. But I often, if it's a complicated patient, we'll usually have a prelim call just to sort of discuss, you know, what they're going through, just to make sure that I can help them and answer some of their preliminary questions, just so they get an idea what I might be able to help them with.
Right. Yeah, that's great. I'm sure people appreciate that. So the website is naturopathicpartners.com.
Yes.
And you have offices in Richfield and Manhattan. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
I am.
Yep. And then it's drmcdonnell@naturopathicpartners.com, and your last name is MCDONNELL.
Perfect.
drmcdonnell@naturopathicpartners.com. And if anyone is interested in learning more about the book, they certainly can purchase that from you. Just contact you via email once that's released. We're looking at about mid-April right now.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I want to read the other chapters.
The other chapters are awesome. I mean, the calls that we've done so far have been great. So everybody has a really interesting topic and lots of information for sure.
Excellent. That's great.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Penelope. And
thank you for all of your hard work, Diane. I really appreciate it. It's just wonderful to have you. You're a great resource for practitioners.
Thank you. You're welcome.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.